And tonight, our speaker is Peaches. And she's my sponsor. And she's also a very, very, very close friend of mine. And she's always carried the principles behind the steps to me and taken me through the big book. And I had 11 years clean and relapsed. And she didn't give up on me. She really stuck by my side tremendously. And one of the things I really love about Peaches is that at every meeting for the last 18 years, after the meeting, I've seen her go up to the newcomer. At every meeting. And she reaches out and she connects females with other females and she introduces males to other males that are working a really good program. And she's just a beautiful example of this program and of love and carrying the message. And she's a great friend and we've laughed a lot. And I just love her from the bottom of my heart. So I think we're really in store for a treat. And this is Peaches.
Hey everybody, my name is Peaches, and I'm a grateful addict and alcoholic.
Peaches.
And that was really sweet. Okay, now you're going to make me start crying. a really good friend of mine who's known me for 17 years called me yesterday afternoon and said, did they take your cat hostage? And I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, I heard that you're telling your story tomorrow night. And I'm like, yeah, it's true, because I don't really do this. And this, I'm doing this for Kate. Even though I've been around for a few 24 hours, I'm really good on the telephone, I'm really good in meetings, I'm really good at coffee, I suck at this part. I don't know, you know, it's just the way it is, so I'm sorry, y'all, but, you know, this is not one of my fortes here, but, you know, I thought, well, should I prepare a lesson, you know, and I didn't grow up in AA where you have notes and all that kind of stuff, where you just get on your knees and you ask God to please, you know, let you be of service to him and to others. And so whatever you get is what God is going to be giving you, because I didn't prepare anything. I know that I'm to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And just to give you a little bit of background, my parents were two totally different people. My mother was an Atlanta debutante, and my dad was a poor farm boy from South Georgia, and I'm something kind of in between. And I knew a lot about alcoholism way before I got here myself. And my parents had big parties when I was growing up. I'm the second child out of five. I have a sister a year older and a sister a year younger, and I have two younger brothers. And my parents had these big parties, and they'd have New Year's parties, and there'd be about 100 people there. And the highlight of my parents' party was our first pony was the little pony, a cart pony. And they'd bring the pony into the house, and they would feed it beer out of a bottle and peanuts, and then the drunk men would try to ride it, and that's just kind of how I grew up. Those were some of my earliest memories of what a party is supposed to be like. And actually, the way we got the pony to begin with is that my mother always wanted us to have ponies. We were really, really little bitty. We didn't even want them yet, but my mother did, so... She found this cart pony in Greenville, Georgia. And, of course, we didn't have a horse trailer or anything like that. So she just took the back seat out of her station wagon and put the pony in that and brought it home. And it lived in the clay tennis court. So we didn't play tennis anyway, so it was okay. And that's just kind of how my family was. We just kind of, you know, everything was a little bit crazy. And but you know, my parents gave me a good, you know, they started out, we had good education, and we took piano lessons, and none of us were any good at that, and we took dancing lessons, and none of us were any good at that, but we did ride horses and ponies, and we were pretty good at that, the girls were anyway, and so that's what we did. But at a very young age, things were already starting to kind of go wrong. People who know me now don't believe me when I tell them that I was extremely shy, extremely introverted. I sucked my thumb, carried a blankie around with me, and would cry if adults said hello to me. I was just totally terrified, and there was a lot of good reasons for that, but they don't believe me when I tell them that now, because I can be rather loud and obnoxious and demanding. But the first treatment center that I was aware of was Willingway, and they were very, very good to my mother. And My first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was way before I ever had my first drink, and that Willingway used to have family weekends at Epworth by the Sea. And we would go to that, and they'd have big family weekends, and my parents would pack the five kids, and we would go, and I learned how to play poker. While the parents were in the meetings, the kids were learning how to play poker, and I think we probably drank a little bit too. And one year we were at Callaway Gardens at an AA family retreat, and they came into a meeting, and they said, somebody's children just jumped in a swimming pool, and this was in the middle of winter. And my parents automatically knew that it was their children who had jumped in the pool. I wasn't one of them, but I had bolder siblings that would do something like that. I just would watch, you know, the trouble. But something happened. We lived in the city. I grew up in Atlanta, went to Lovett School for elementary school, and then something happened, and I'm not sure, there's a lot of stories, different versions between my mother and my father, but we all of a sudden ended up on a farm in Carrollton, outside of Carrollton, two bedrooms, one bathroom, seven people. Now, this was after living on West Paces Ferry in West Wesley. So it was kind of a culture shock. But we all adapted. We took all of our horses and ponies with us and, you know, tried to get along the best we could. And by that time, you know, I was now more familiar with a couple of other different treatment centers, but not personally yet. And you know, we went to school down there and rode our horses and collected more horses. In fact, there was a pony tied to a tree that we would see on the way to school, and it didn't have a water bucket. My mother just felt terrible about that. So she, by this time, did have a horse trailer. And so she hooked a horse trailer up to the car when she took us to school and stopped by the people's house and said, can I have that pony? Because she just felt sorry because it was, you know, didn't look like it was doing too well. So she just would collect animals like that. And we had horses, dogs, cats, gerbils, you know, we had a monkey, a raccoon, a little bit of everything. And it just kind of, is anybody old enough to have seen Green Acres before? That was us, you know. My dad still, he was a lawyer and he still worked in Atlanta, and he just left my poor buckhead mother down this farm with five children, all these horses and animals, which she was pretty much fine with, but the house was definitely a Green Acres house. And we decided that we needed to build a house for all of us to live in, but it was more important for the horses to have a house first. So we got into building this barn, and the barn got a little bit out of control, and so we never did build a house, but we did build a barn. And so I lived in the barn because it was much nicer than the house anyway. And my two sisters and I, and then my mother and father decided to separate, and so my dad and my two brothers lived in the little farmhouse, and us girls lived in the barn, and then my mother would go drive down to the house to go fix breakfast for everybody, and that was my parents' first separation. We lived on the same farm, just different houses. Well, at about the age of 13, I was still very, very terrified and very shy, and it was time for me to start doing drugs and alcohol. And one of my girlfriends had brought some pills she had found in her mother's cabinet, and we got some beers, and I guess they were like muscle relaxers or something like that, but they really didn't do a whole lot for us. I guess we didn't have enough beer and the pills weren't strong enough or something, but that was my first introduction to drugs. But I had another girlfriend who was really wild, and I went out with her, and the first time I ever drank and got really drunk, had a blackout, and woke up in my own vomit the next day. And so my disease progressed from that point. And I was perfectly more than willing to do that again, and did for a very, very long time. And my mother was actually able to put 4 years together. And we were showing horses and stuff like that, and by that time, I was smoking pot and taking pills and drinking, and we actually turned my mother on to pot, and she thought that was interesting, and that we had to roll our own, and she thought that was very, very tacky. that you had to roll your own. But we kind of contributed to my mother's relapse at that time, and then it became kind of like a family thing. And we did some pretty strange things, like, you know, my sister and her boyfriend put THC in my mother's coffee, and but they told her before she drank it all that she had the option of either finishing it or not, and she chose to finish it. But so it got, relationships in my family kind of got distorted. My dad was never home because he was a workaholic and he was working, and my sisters and I were getting heavily into drugs and alcohol. I don't know, I just thought that's what everybody did. Everybody I hung out with, that's what we did. And before I knew it, I was taking Quaaludes, PCP, THC, mushrooms, mescaline, whatever was out there, I was taking. And it didn't matter if it was a hallucinogenic or an upper or a downer or alcohol or marijuana. It didn't matter. I did it. And, you know, the first time I ever did mushrooms, someone said, you know, if when you do this, you're going to, about 30 minutes later, you're going to feel really, really sick, and you're probably going to throw up and feel horrible. I'm like, okay, and drank it, you know. Why would anybody do that? I'm thinking now, but, you know, at that time, it seemed perfectly, yeah, let's do it, you know. And that's just kind of how I went through my teenage years, is just a lot of drugs and alcohol and a great time, and everybody else was doing it. And, you know, we lived on a big farm. It was a little bit over 500 acres, and everybody came out and hung out with us. And, you know, you could literally take a trip and never leave the farm. And we did that a lot. And I guess my parents were okay with that because, you know, we kept doing it. And my dad did try to stop some of it. He'd come up with his shotgun and try to run people off, you know, if it was really late or something like that. But anybody'd always come back, and it didn't last very long. But anyway, we moved back to the city when I was a senior in high school, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to kind of clean up my act a little bit because some of these drugs and things are not socially acceptable. So I was trying to limit my drug addiction a little bit anyway, and it was very difficult to do that. And but that's when I got, and I said, you know, my alcoholism just, you know, it progressed from the blackout and throwing up all over myself. And I did control it a lot with the drugs that I took, but it was always the major problem I had. And by this time I was introduced to several more treatment centers, but none for myself. I got really good at putting my mother in treatment and denying that I had a problem. And I've been to all the treatment centers in town, and or taking my mother to all of them, some of them who would not invite us back. But we've been to Ridgeview, Peachford, Parkwood, Willing Way, Psychiatric Institute of Atlanta, Northside, Fulton County Detox. And, you know, I knew all these places and all these people, and but I was not the problem. It was always, you know, my mother. And I just would not recognize that I had a problem. Until I end up with, when I tried to clean up my act and do socially acceptable drugs, I got introduced to cocaine, which I really didn't like when I first did it, because I was like, it really doesn't do a whole lot for me, you know, because I was used to taking drugs that actually did something for me. But I got addicted to it anyway. And I went off to college, and I did fine in school. I can go to school all day long. It, you know, I liked going to school. But when I got out of school, I could not function. My dad said I could either go to law school or go to work, and I was way too burned out to go to law school. And I couldn't work, though. You know, I tried, and you know, I went through the newspaper and got a sales job selling vacuum cleaners, and that lasted a couple of weeks, and I'm like, I don't know how to do anything. I mean, I knew how to go to school, and I knew how to make grades, but I didn't know how to do anything else because I was not prepared to do anything. And I ended up around a lot of drug dealers and stuff like that, and that's just pretty much what I did, but that didn't last very long either. And My parents came and tried to get me from the situation. I was in a really bad situation, as most of us end up in really bad situations. I was in psychosis and in a dangerous place. And my parents came to get me, and they said, you know, we've got a bed waiting for you at West Paces Ferry Hospital. And I said, you know, I'm just not going. You know, I'm just not going. And they couldn't get me out of where I was. And I know it was really hurtful to both my parents, who by this point had gotten divorced but gotten back together several times. And something that I'd left out, things got really messed up in that both of my parents ended up using cocaine and Quaaludes and alcohol, and I ended up using with my parents, which kind of screwed up our relationship. I mean, I didn't know who the parent and the child was in the relationship, and it was very disturbing. And I had my first real long-term relationship in college, and when we broke up, I was just very distraught over that and knew that I was not getting over that relationship. So I went to the University of Georgia's, whatever, they had health department, and they had, you know, counselors there. So I went to the counselor, and I said, look, I broke up with this guy, and it's not working out. I'm really sad, and I'm just not getting over it. And, you know, and he wanted to know about my drug use. I'm like, well, that didn't have anything to do with it. And then, you know, he wanted to know if I could actually go home and not use drugs with my parents and come back to school. I'm like, no. And I went to him a few times, and he was more concerned about my drug habit and my using drugs with my parents than he was about me not being able to get over this relationship. And then he asked me to write a paper about who I was. And let me tell you, I could not write a paper about who I was. I could write papers all day long for college, but I could not sit down and write about who I was. I could not go back to him after that. And so drug addiction continued on, and then and Father's Day in 1984, I pretty much had hit my bottom by then, and I was in a really dangerous situation. And I called my dad, and he came and got me, and my cat. And of course, you know, he got some cocaine from the guy I was living with before we left the house, and he pumped me full of Valium and full of alcohol, and went to my mom, who at this point had 9 months sober. And they decided that they could put me in treatment because I was out of it enough to where I couldn't make any, you know, I couldn't say no. And they actually gave me a couple of choices, which was kind of amazing. And, but they sent me to Chartered by the Sea in St. Simons because they thought it would probably be good to get me out of town and away from the person I had been living with. So I went to treatment down there, and I think they had to start my treatment over a couple times while I was there because I was just not all there. And I really liked being in treatment. I don't know why. I mean, maybe because it was a new treatment center at the time. My counselors only had 2 years sober, and they were pretty whack, and it was pretty relaxed there, and we got to go to the beach on the weekends, and we walked to Epworth by the Sea every day, and we had Charter Health Facility next door, and, you know, it was kind of like going to a country club, and the food was really good, too. And so I had never wanted to stop using drugs and alcohol ever. I had never, ever tried to quit using drugs and alcohol. It never crossed my mind because I didn't want to think about having to live without drugs or alcohol. But I got in the treatment center, and there were some pretty cool people. I had been pretty much a hostage where I'd been living before and not really gotten out and around a lot of people, so that was pretty much fun. And I managed to stay out of trouble pretty much while I was there, but they just didn't have a lot of hope for me there. But I do remember every week we'd get in a circle and have this gratitude meeting, and everybody would have to go around and say what they were grateful for. And I knew nothing about gratitude, but I would say something just to participate because I'm a great student. And but that was the first introduction to gratitude, was that, you know, it was a forced thing in a circle, and, you know, so I could play that game, and I did. But they didn't know what to do with me with treatment because I just wasn't really all there and not getting it. So they sent me to a halfway house because my mother certainly wouldn't take me back because she couldn't get sober with me living in the house with her, and I had nowhere else to go. And I had really no job and no valid driver's license, no health insurance, no car insurance, no nothing. I mean, I don't even know how my cars ran. I never even changed the oil in my car. I just get in and drive. I mean, I didn't know you were supposed to do all this other stuff. And I was not prepared for real life. And they sent me to MAR here in Atlanta. I mean, they didn't let me go home. You know, they like picked me up at the airport and took me straight to the halfway house. And then they put me in DAC from there, and it was all right. I wasn't crazy about it, but I had nowhere to go. And so, I just followed directions. Now, they had some problems with me, and they drug screened me a couple times. They thought that I was using drugs. And, I looked, acted, and felt like I was on drugs, but I wasn't. I was living off the residual effects, but I was not doing drugs. But it was very, very, I had done so many for so many years that I was not all there. And even when I left treatment, they said there was not a chance in hell for me. And after they did the psych eval, they told my parents that even if I managed to stay sober, that I probably was not going to be all there. But you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous works miracles, and God works miracles through Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't have all my brain functions, but I'm pretty much more there than they thought I would be. And but I finished the DAC program, and someone asked me, we were talking the other night, and someone asked me about, did I do mirror imaging at DAC? And I'm like, I don't even know what I did there. I just remember a meeting there. I remember a couple of things we did, but I don't remember DAC at all. And I barely remember the halfway house. But I was in a roommate with a girl in the halfway house who said, there's a really good meeting that we can go to. It's a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. I'm like, okay, whatever. And she took me there. And well, you know what? All the good looking guys were there. So I was hooked and ready to go back to that meeting. And that really was a blessing in disguise, because at that time that was a very, very small group. And I kind of enjoyed the people I met and enjoyed the people I was with, and everybody was close to the same age. No one had any sobriety, so we were all kind of whacked together, and everybody had to participate in service work because we were it. And two older gentlemen from 8111 were helping us out, Doc Crandall and Bill Hollingsworth, and they were from old hardcore AA. And this is the kind of information I got when I got out of the halfway house and started going to meetings. They would tell you stuff like, take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. They would go, 90 meetings in 90 days. If you don't like it, we'll refund your misery. And they said, if you start whining and crying, they say, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. And there was no love, okay? It was tough love in there. But that's what I needed at the time, and that's what I got. And they were very hardcore, and so they said, look, if you really want to stay sober, then you'll plan your day around a meeting, period, end of story, real simple. They said, you need to not use no matter what, even if your ass falls off. They said, put it in a bag, bring it to a meeting. I'm like, okay. And then Doc said, at some point in time, you're going to be confronted with drugs or alcohol, and you need to have a plan of action before that happens. And he said that plan of action probably means that you need to know that you're going to turn around and walk away and call somebody for help, or but you're going to leave that situation. And I encountered that really early on, because I don't learn real fast, and I kept going back to the house where I was living before and to the guy I was living with, who was a drug dealer, and I thought it'd still be okay to go see him, right? And I had about, 4, 5, 6 months in the program, and I went over there, and there was a huge rock sitting on the dresser. And without even thinking, I threw it in a D-ring and, you know, cranked it up and had a D-ring in one hand and a straw in the other. And you know what? I put it down and I walked out the door. And that was not me. That was the grace of God. Okay? Because, I mean, I don't know where that came from. But it really did freak me out. And somewhere in between the first day and 6 months, I actually decided, you know what, I do want to be clean and sober. Because, you know, I didn't have any idea that I had ever really wanted to be clean and sober. I knew, you know, all about AA and stuff, but I didn't know that I wanted to be clean and sober. But at that point, I did. And some other old-timer AA stuff, they tell you, they're like, you need to hit your knees every day. And what they used to tell people is they tell people, you know, put your shoes under the bed so that you have to get on your knees in the morning to, you know, get your shoes out from under the bed. While you're there, you can pray. Well, you know, I had 15 pairs of shoes. I didn't need to put, you know, one under the bed. I guess that was back when people only had one pair of shoes and not 15. But I tried praying, laying on my back and, you know, just driving my car. And I was an emotionally disturbed person. And I finally decided, okay, after I hear things like 30 times, I'll start maybe doing it. But I got to hear it like 30 times before I'll actually take the suggestion. And I started getting on my knees, and I really was very, very agnostic. And I would pray to whoever, whatever was out there. I'd get on my knees and just say, please help me stay sober today. And then again at night, I'd say, thank you for helping me stay sober today. And I've been doing that ever since. And after doing that for a while, you know, I started to feel different. I started to feel some kind of hope. I started to feel some kind of spark. I started to feel different. And it's just been a real important part of my everyday life to get on my knees twice a day. And to go to a meeting every day. I did that for a very, very long time. I didn't have anything else to do. Now, the halfway house told me I had to get a job. Well, I didn't have any skills. I had 2 college degrees, but I didn't have any skills. And so one of the little guys in the program got me a job with a builder in the program, and who happened to be off in a relapse. And so they had me answering his phones while he was out on his relapse. And I screwed that up. I mean, I only had 2 incoming lines, and I couldn't even do that. And it was really difficult, and I had really bad anxiety attacks. But I just didn't use, and I went to a meeting every day, and sometimes I went twice a day, go at 5:45 and again at 8, and I was told to get involved in service work, which, you know, in CA you didn't have a choice because, you know, we're a limited number of people, and, you know, set up chairs, make coffee, give people rides, you know, chair meetings, lead discussion, whatever it was that we were told to do, that's what we did. And we had to be our own little service organization also for a long time, and did that. And, you know, I just kept doing that one day at a time, not using, going to meetings, playing the whole life. About, I didn't have a life anyway. No husband, no children, no career, no nothing, which was probably a really good thing. And I was young, so I didn't have anything else to do but not use and go to meetings and do service work. And that worked for me for a long time. And I was really good at the first step and the 12th step. It was all that stuff in between, you know, that I went through really fast with the first few sponsors, you know, and you go through all the steps, blah, 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 whatever, but I was just, you know, doing the first and 12th step for the most part, and I was very depressed, and at around 3 years, I almost died of self-pity, literally. I was not suicidal, I was not homicidal, although I had those tendencies a little bit, but I really just wanted just to sit on the edge of the bed and just quit breathing, because I really thought that my life sucked at 3 years sober. I was overweight, didn't have any relationship, didn't have any money, didn't have any skills, didn't have a decent job, and I'm like, but I went to lots of meetings, sponsored 5 people, you know, did all that stuff, and I'm like, I think I'm getting the short end of the stick here. You know, I'm doing everything right, but, you know, everything in my life sucks. And I had a really good sponsor at that time, and she used to spend 30 minutes every morning in prayer and meditation. So I was going to try to mimic that, because I was used to just reading those books really fast and being late to work, just for the 2 seconds I spent on that. But I started doing that, and she had me read the third step prayer every day, and then she had me write a gratitude list. And my first 5 years in the program, I went to a lot of AA retreats, and I went to Women in Recovery, and a lot of stuff like that. And I really highly recommend doing stuff like that. I don't think I would be standing here today if I did not eat, sleep, and breathe the program when I first got here and built a foundation. I really just don't think that would happen. So I wrote a gratitude list and started reading it every day, and I really, really think that that started to help some. But you know, I was still restless, irritable, and discontent, and nothing in my life was going right, or so I thought. And you know, my mother used to tell me, she goes, "Oh, your time will come." Well, you know what, I don't ever want to say that to anybody, because I hate it when my mother used to say that to me. "Your time will come? Uh-uh." It's, look, I'm getting kind of old here. And you know, my sister, who always had people financially taking care of her, would say, "Oh, you're just standing on the hose." I'm like, what do you mean standing on the hose? And I just didn't understand, so I won't ever say that to anybody either. But I wanted a quick fix. I went to Codependency Anonymous. I went to Adult Children. I tried everything to get the quick fix. And I did go to therapy, and I found a wonderful therapist who wouldn't make me do experiential or any other kind of weird therapy. I just wanted someone to sit there and be nice to me and listen to me. And she was really good at that, and I'm very, very grateful for her. But I just was looking for something to fix me, anything. And, you know, I was right in the middle of it, because it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was sitting in a meeting at 5 years sober, and a guy sitting there that I kind of knew, and he said something about a big book study. Well, I'd never heard of a big book study before. But I knew when I heard it, I was like, damn, I'm going to have to do that. So I just knew, you know, that was what I was going to have to go do. So I actually went to a big book study. I'd never heard of that before. I mean, I was pretty relatively familiar with the book and knew how to, you know, where certain things in the book were and stuff like that, but never been to a big book study, never heard of it before. And they've been around for a while. But I went, and it was a different style meeting, and that this guy just, you know, pretty much was like the teacher and he was a student. And I kind of liked that because I liked being a student. A lot of people didn't like that because they wanted to have to say what they needed to say. But I needed to listen at that point. And I was having a lot of problems. I thought that I was going to be emotionally disturbed the rest of my life because I was very emotionally disturbed. I felt like that because of my family and my parents and the way I grew up, that I was screwed for life, and that I just could never get anything right. But I just, you know, kept not using and going to meetings and trying to be of service to others, and went to this big book study. And I was ranting and raving about something. And the guy that led the big book study said, "When was the last time you did, you know, a fifth step?" And I'm like, I mean, I was on the binge and purge method already with the fourth and fifth step. You know, I'd do a fourth and fifth step, and then I'd collect a whole lot more crap to, you know, put together. And just, you know, it was like the binge and purge method. And I did that for a long time. I said, it's probably been 6 months since I did the last one, you know. And he said, "You need to do another one." And it was really mainly just my dad and my older sister, who I was totally jealous of. And he sat down and took me through how to do a fourth and fifth step out of the big book. And he was very, very patient with me. But something that no one had ever done with me before, and maybe they had and I just didn't hear it, because I don't hear things for several times. After we had gone through certain parts of it, he asked me, he says, "Now you need to write down what," because, you know, I'd written down all the resentments I had with my dad. He said, "You need to write down what kind of daughter you were." Tough. "What kind of sister was I?" That's very tough. So he made me look at stuff like, you know, forget about what kind of parents your parents were. What kind of daughter were you to your parents? You know, what kind of sister are you to your siblings? You know, what kind of employee are you? You know, because it was always my employer, my parents, my siblings, everybody but me. And that was really hard to look at. Really hard to look at. And I started writing down. I'm like, Jesus Christ, I didn't know this. And that was the beginning of a breakthrough for me. To start looking at myself. I mean, I had read the part in the big book about selfishness and self-centeredness and all that kind of stuff, and but I just never incorporated it. And so I kept going back to this big book study and started learning how to live the principles behind the steps. All of them, not just the first and 12th one. All of them. And you know what? My life started to change. I started to not feel quite as sorry for myself. I just became a little bit better employee. I actually could get a couple. Every time I got a job, though, I have to tell you, I got it through someone who was in the program and always worked for somebody in the program. Because I was terrified outside of the program and went to a lot of meetings, sponsored people, learned how to take people through the book, but still had, you know, some problems. And but you know what? My life started to get better. And it was really amazing. I wasn't feeling sorry for myself all the time. I wasn't crying all the time. I had such low self-esteem at one point in time, and this was one reason, and I was actually in therapy at the time. I was at work and I just started crying because I felt so bad about myself. I've been in a job interview before, and I hated job interviews. And I cried in a job interview because she was asking me about me, and I'm like, I started crying. I didn't get that job. But things started getting a little bit better. I went through a couple of little short-term relationships early in the program, and then I had one good long-term one, and that was really good, and I learned a lot from that, and that, you know, took a forked path, and met another guy, and I have to be honest about this. Usually my relationships don't work out because I usually pick people who are not very sober, and I'm not very good at that. But I just didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and it was getting more and more difficult because I was getting older and I needed to have a real job, and you know, I needed to be able to learn how to support myself, and you know, I didn't know how to do that. And by that time my father's alcoholism and drug addiction had gotten bad enough to where he had lost his money, and so he wasn't financially backing me anymore. And I was like, what the hell am I gonna do? So I had to find some kind of real job, and I went back to school, and I became, well, actually, I went back to school to be a school teacher because I figured, you know what, if I'm never going to make any money, I might as well do something that I really like, and I love going to school, so maybe, you know, being a teacher, which would never have crossed my mind before because I was going to be a lawyer, and a teacher never crossed my mind. But I went to school to become a teacher, and of course couldn't get a job as a teacher, so, you know, career stuff continued to not be good, and got a paralegal certificate. Worked in a law office, and that was okay. I mean, I was really excited the first 6 months, but after that I was really bored. Of course, I was working for people in the program still. But somewhere down the road, I went back to school and got a teaching certificate to teach middle school, because there's a lot of turnover in middle school, and now I know why. So, I took a job. The first job I could get, the first one offered to me, because I had been trying for a long time to get a job teaching, was to teach eighth grade. And it was in East Point in Southwest Atlanta. And people had already asked me about children, say, do you ever want children? I'm like, no, I'm not a baby person. I just want them 13 and up. Well, I'm teaching eighth grade. This is what God will do to you if you keep telling people these things. And had another good relationship, but that one ended too because, you know, drugs and alcohol were more important than me. And But I ended up teaching school, which was pretty cool. And it was something I actually had the skills to do, I found out. Not initially, but I'm getting better as the years go on. But, you know, by that time, you know, I had 10 years sober, and my life is going really well, and the program's going well, and, you know, relationship, blah, 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 everything's going really well. Well, then I get this career, and I have to start learning how to work the steps all over again. Because you have no idea what powerlessness is until you get into an eighth grade classroom. Or work with educational administrators. So I had to learn all over again about working the steps, about being grateful, about how to make amends to people immediately because, you know, personalities kind of clashed at certain points. And that was one thing that I learned early on. Well, not early on, but, you know, after being around for about 7 years, to learn how to make amends immediately. You know, once I got past doing the first and 12th step, I started learning how to, like, you know, do some of the other stuff. And one of those was to learn how to clean up my side of the street. And I know now that when I have a resentment against somebody and someone's really made me angry, I know that I need to go make my amends to that person for whatever reason, because that resentment with that person is not going to go away unless I clean my side of the street first. And it was really hard to do at first, but you know what? It feels a lot better than carrying that resentment around. It feels a whole lot better than carrying that resentment around. I don't feel emotionally disturbed anymore, although a doctor kind of made me feel like it a little bit at one point in time. I've been really adamant about, and really fortunate that I haven't had to take medication in sobriety. I've had a lot of physical problems, and at one point they needed to do some procedures that required me to have drugs, and I let them do stick a tube down my throat and into my stomach without taking any drugs because I wouldn't take any. But another procedure they did, they said, we're going to have to IV you Demerol and Valium. And I'm sitting in that doctor's office, and I have 8 years sober, and I was just in tears. I said, I cannot do this, because I was terrified. 8 years, I'm terrified. And I went to the big book study guy and all that kind of stuff, and because people had me freaked. Everybody's going to go, oh, you're going to be on a pharmacological relapse. You need to do this. You need to do that, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, they had me freaked. And I went to this guy, and I said, I'm freaked. And this is what people tell me. He goes, do you feel connected to your higher power? And I said, yes. And he goes, then what's the problem? It was that simple. That's all he had to say. It was that simple. And I ran into a doctor in the program, and he said, here's something else that you can do instead of those drugs. It only has a half-life, and I did that and got through the procedure fine, and didn't have to do that. But my father ended up with cancer and passed away 3 years ago, and I'd lost my last relationship at the same time. And I'd started gaining weight again and getting emotionally disturbed again and having more physical problems. And I was in a doctor's office, and she's like, we need to put you on something. And because I was in bad shape. And I said, no, I've been through worse, and I think I can get through this. And then I ended up with bronchial pneumonia also, because I was just, whenever I'm emotionally sick, I get physically sick as well. And I wouldn't take any narcotics. I said, you really need to, but they have stuff that you can take that's non-narcotic, and I did that. And I've been really fortunate that I haven't had to have any surgeries or anything, because I've been around a lot of friends who have had to take medications, and it's been really difficult for them. And I'm still, even though I've been clean for a number of years, there's still little signs that let me know that, you know, I'm still a drug addict. We went on this picnic with my school last month, and we had to walk the kids up to the park and walk back, and we're walking back, been outside in the hot sun all day long, walking down past these yards, and, you know, I see paper in this yard, and I immediately know that it's a script, you know? And so I'm, like, reaching for it and looking at it, and it's Ativan and Lorazette, and I'm like, asked the girl next to me, I said, do you want these? Because, you know, this is still a good script, you know, you can get this filled. I mean, I don't want good drugs to go to waste. So I know I still need to go to meetings and not use. But I do truly believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because they took a broken child from a broken family who even my treatment center said there was no hope for me. And I have a wonderful life today. I'm grateful for my life today. I have a good relationship with my family, which it took a long time to put that together. I get along with my siblings. My mom and I have a good relationship. I had a good relationship with my dad before he died. I was very fortunate that we knew ahead of time that he was going to die so that, you know, I could spend some time with him. And I have a lot of good friends. I mean, my biggest problem today is I have too many friends because there's just so many wonderful people in these rooms that I've really gotten attached to. And they're really good friends. A lot of the people that I got clean with are still sober today. In fact, I'm taking a trip on Sunday, and five of us are going on a trip, but four of us, we've known each other since we were 15. And we're all clean and sober, and they have more sobriety than I do. You know, there were four of us girls that ran together in high school and college, and three out of four of us are all clean together. And those are pretty good statistics. But I am truly, truly grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've seen it help all kinds of people. God speaks to me through the people in these rooms. And when people come in here and they share and tell about their lives or their difficulties or whatever they've gone through, I latch on to that because I've had to go through those difficulties later on. I'm like, you know, he made it, she made it, he did it, she did it, I can do it too. And it's a we program. We can do what I cannot. And we've been able to help me stay clean and sober one day at a time. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. Thank you.
Peaches, that was truly awesome. It was really, really great. Thank you so much for sharing that.